is CoDiscovery. Hello and welcome to this episode of CoDiscovery with me, Abigail Acton. From satellites observing the Earth to roots and the microbes that surround them, today we're looking at soil and how our food security depends on its health. Soil is so much more than the dirt beneath our feet. It's a fragile resource which is degraded in many parts of the world, and the rapidly growing global population's demand for food, fiber, and soil-derived materials is ramping up the pressure. How can we feed people while rethinking our dependence on chemical fertilizers? Can we process wastewater in a way that can benefit farmers and boost crop yields? And what can the structure of a plant's roots tell us about what's going on underground? Can that knowledge lead to a reduction in the need for nitrogen-based fertilizers? How can remote sensing and earth observation data help us to improve our use of natural resources to improve food security? Today's crop of guests has been funded by the Horizon 2020 program. They are here to help us understand how waste, fertilizer, soil protection, and remote monitoring all interconnect. A researcher at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Tania Galindo-Castaneda's focus is on how the root anatomy and architecture of maize affects the impact that microbes in the soil have on the plant. Hello, Tania.
Hello, Abigail and everyone. Thanks for this invitation.
You're very welcome. Frank Rugala is Director of Innovation at Aquila, a private provider of water services supplying 45 million people in 17 countries. His focus is on not wasting one drop of water, to which end he fuels his car with wastewater. Frank is interested in recovering fertilizers to grow food and avoid pollution. Welcome, Frank.
Great to be here, Abigail. Hello.
Juan Suarez is looking at how to make the most of Earth observation technologies, such as satellite imagery, to improve food security and sustainable development. Juan is a senior manager at the Spanish company, GMV. Welcome, Juan.
Hello, Abigail. Hello, everyone. Nice to see you.
What causes a plant to flourish once planted out of the lab and into a field? Tania, your root phenobiome project looked at maize and how the roots interact with the community of microbes in the soil. I know that you're interested in biofertilizers. What does that word mean exactly, and why are they important, do you feel?
Okay, so biofertilizers are preparations containing living microbial cells, which make nutrients available to plants. They are important because they are profiling as an alternative to chemical fertilization in agricultural fields. Therefore, their use is being researched actively right now.
Are these used already in other countries?
Yes, they have been in use for quite a while in South America, for example, in Brazil. They have a whole program by the government where they select microbes to produce these biofertilizers. And even there, they have proposed that 25% of chemical fertilization can be replaced by these biofertilizers.
Uh-huh. And how does one decide what microbes are going to be helpful to the plant?
Well, microbes can, in the case of nitrogen, for example, they can fix nitrogen, which is very abundant in the air. And they, some of them, not all biofertilizers, but some biofertilizers or some microbes in the soil, they have the metabolic capability to obtain nitrogen from the air and make it available in the form of ammonium to plants.
Oh, that's wonderful. So instead of adding this on externally as a compound in a fertilizer, in fact, we can actually just let the natural process do its work and provide the plants with the same nutrients that way.
Exactly. Yes, this can happen naturally, but we can also favor high grades of this process by selecting specific strains that have improved capabilities to do this, for example, nitrogen fixation.
Fantastic. And why aren't we all doing that all the time right now? What's holding us up from actually using these more?
Yeah, the way biofertilizers are produced and used is not so predictable as with chemical fertilizers. So, for example, when they make a new nitrogen fertilization, they know that they will use this amount, for example, 100 kilos per hectare, and they will get certain amount of grain in the case of maize. But for biofertilizers, we need to research much more to have this kind of equivalences between what we apply and what we obtain. So to ensure that the biofertilizers work, we need more research. And I think it's just the stage in which the research is in most of the maize producing countries, for example.
And this, of course, is what you're looking at. So one of the things I believe that's interesting you is that the structure or the architecture of the root systems of maize has an impact on how these microbes respond to the plant. So can you tell me a little bit more about that? And perhaps also, is that one of the reasons why it seems to work quite well in laboratories and sometimes not quite so effectively in the field? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, exactly. So one of the huge black boxes that we have in developing and using microbes in agriculture is trying to understand the biology of these microbes and how they connect and how they associate with the roots. Because usually biofertilizers are produced in the lab, then they are tested also in the lab, then in the greenhouse, where the roots are not really growing in the way they grow in the field. So we don't know exactly how in the field these different shapes of roots, like architectural or anatomical, which refers to the internal distribution of tissues, how these different characteristics interact with microbes in real conditions. So we need to understand better how these processes, how this architecture and anatomy influence microbes. And I think this could help make the link between what we do in the lab and in the bioreactor when they produce this at the industrial scale and what happens in the field.
Uh-huh. Is it possible that some of the microbes already present in the soil in the natural environment are having a kind of a, I presume they must have some sort of connection, impact, interaction with the microbes that are being taken out of laboratory scenarios to be used as fertilizers?
Yes, this is very highly possible. I think this we also need to understand, because when the plant starts growing, it recruits some microbiome in the rhizosphere or on the roots and inside the roots. And then we don't know if we apply an external microbe, if it will have any impact in the soil surrounding the roots or on the plant. So yes, there are microbes that are already doing a lot of nutrient transformation for the plant. But if we include an external microbe that we have selected by with our methods, yes, we don't know what happens. This is also a part of the black box that we have in biofertilizers.
It sounds like you have a nice long path of research in front of you, a good strong career in research in this area.
But it's
very lots of interesting questions to find answers for, absolutely. But obviously it's very important, because you're talking here about a way of boosting crop yields in a way that actually has much less of a harsh environmental impact, yes?
Exactly, because with the chemical fertilizers, we farmers to obtain the amounts of grain that they need to make it profitable or to improve their welfare, they need to apply excess of chemical fertilizers. Therefore, this is creating pollution and economic losses, of course. So yes, it will be important to, as an alternative, to make use of the biological resource that is already in the soil.
That's right, and sort of targeted for a particular goal.
Yes.
Super, very interesting. Thank you very much. And I think also probably good for soil health, I would imagine, because you're not introducing a large amount of chemicals like nitrogens, phosphates, etc. You're actually going with the communities that are already living in the soil. So I would imagine it's better for soil health, do you think?
Yes. When farmers apply chemical fertilizers in excess, they change the chemical balance of the soil, and also it creates pollution, as I said, for example, nitrogen volatilizes, and sometimes it is lost to the watersheds. So yes, it's better to have a reduction, at least in inputs, if this is possible.
Yeah.
Yes, but something that I also wanted to say is that plants also have their adaptations to this, and we don't know how the already in place plant adaptation that they come with the genetics, with their plant breeding, with their seeds, are interacting with these microbes. So this is also a black box that we need to solve. Plants already have some adaptations to use perhaps less available nutrients. And if we are applying microbes, maybe we have synergies or trade-offs. We don't know.
If you were to project yourself into the future, should we say 10 years? So it's a little bit ahead, not massively ahead. Where would you like to see this technology that you're working on be? In other words, at what stage do you think we could imagine it would be in 10 years' time?
I would like to see a technology that is combining plant varieties or cultivars with adapted roots to obtain nutrients more efficiently from the soil. So with specific architectures and anatomies, but also with an inoculant composed perhaps by a consortium of microbes or by certain strains.
What do you mean by inoculant?
Inoculants are bacteria, are biofertilizers, let's say, are products containing bacteria, living bacteria or fungi that help plants, in this case, make nutrients more available. So yes, I imagine not only plants that are selected because they have adapted roots, but also because they favor synergistic associations with soil microbes and that require less fertilization, less chemical fertilization, and therefore a reduction in the environmental impact.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, I mean, we have to hope that it actually is something that we do see in the next 10 years or so. That would be excellent. Thank you very, very much. That's super. Well, I'd like to stay on the subject of enriching the soil naturally or artificially. And I'm going to turn to Frank here because, Frank, the Run for Life project focused on processing wastewater in the most effective way possible, including the recovery of nutrients that can be used as fertilizers. So we've just been considering the idea of plants using the microbes in the soil to actually maximize the uptake of nutrients. But here we're actually thinking now about how, if we do, while Tanya does her fantastic work, continue to need classical fertilizers, what are the best ways to get them? So what is the gap in the current way that we deal with wastewater that motivated you to try and innovate the process? What was something that you felt was missing?
Well, if you think about it today, the infrastructure we have, we use a lot of clean water to wash away our waste. And the waste is, in fact, a resource. There is a lot of fertilizer in urine and in other human waste and also in kitchen waste. So we can recover nitrogen and phosphorus from the waste material instead of flushing it all down the drain to some wastewater treatment plant far away where it's very, very difficult to recover. And all that with clean water, we at the same time waste the resource and contaminate the clean water that is drinking water that could be used much more efficiently if it wasn't just to transport waste.
I like the idea, we've talked about this obviously beforehand, I like the idea that you had about the notion of separating out wastewater rather like we separate our own sort of hard waste streams for recycling, our plastic and our paper and our whatever. The idea that in fact actually with wastewater we should be separating it out more effectively as well.
Indeed, that was the inspiration, obviously, that in waste, in order to recycle it efficiently, you need to separate the glass and the paper and the plastic. And the same we can do with water. We can separate yellow water and brown water and gray water and then reuse each resource the way it could easily be, because the yellow water, 90% of the nitrogen that each person produces is concentrated in only 1 liter of urine or two per day. Instead of flushing it down with 200 liters of clean water as the normal toilets do, we could recover this concentrated liquid fertilizer. And the same goes for gray water. It's easy to reuse, is less contaminated if we don't mix it all together, and we can then reuse it to flush toilets, wash cars, or whatever is objective we have.
Yeah, so something that's much more targeted. After all, most of our infrastructure is based on technology that was pretty much exploited by the Romans. We haven't really gotten much more up to date, have we?
Yeah, the Romans obviously invented that to bring water from far away with aqueducts to the cities and then used it to flush out the waste as fast as possible into the Cloaca Maxima or whatever river was close by. And that was maybe sustainable when you had a few hundred or a thousand people, but not in a city of a million. And therefore, we now pump all this waste out to a faraway place where it creates a new problem of contaminating wastewater and contaminating rivers and producing sludge that nobody wants. And we obviously wanted to avoid this and recover the nutrients at a place where they can be used inside of the household, where you can use the fertilizer for gardening or can reuse your water for washing locally rather than when you have it far away in a wastewater treatment plant.
Indeed. And so let's explore the notion of the fertilizers, because we're interested today in soil health, fertilizers and food security boosting crops. So once you've separated out the water, what's actually happening now to produce fertilizer from this water?
Yeah, we had various tests. We actually worked with partners in Sweden, with partners in Holland, with partners in Belgium. In each case, there was a new city being developed where they could reinvent a little bit the way buildings are built and therefore have separate pipes for yellow water or gray water or brown water. And then each stream you can treat separately. The black water can be transformed into an organic fertilizer. The yellow water I already mentioned is by itself a liquid fertilizer, and the gray water is another resource we can use. But we tested in each location a different approach, sometimes focusing on the organics, sometimes focusing on extracting then or putting the liquid into a more easy, handleable form of pellets, extracting from the urine some nitrogen and phosphorus pellets that then the farmers or the gardeners could use on their field.
Ah, and what's the uptake like? You mentioned these pilot projects. I mean, they sound. I guess you feel that they went successfully. And is industry interested in this? Are you getting to the stage now where you could actually market this in any way, or are we still in pilot project stage? Do you feel?
Well, as it is a radical change in the way people behave, because you have to readapt your toilet and think a little bit differently how you actually take value out of your waste. It depends a lot on the infrastructure. Therefore, these apartments or these new buildings were built so that people would be enticed to separate their waste materials. And in those cases, it was very successful. Obviously, it's easier to do in a new development than retrofitting existing building with new pipes. But in those new developments, where often people come also with new ideas of how they can be more sustainable, there was a big uptake and people were very happy actually to be able to contribute to a more sustainable solution.
Absolutely. You know, I can well imagine. But I take your point about it being easier to set up in an environment where you're building from scratch. With regards to the pilot projects that you did, could you give me an example of one of the pilot projects? I'm interested in the pellet idea for fertilizers. Where was that actually conducted and how many households were involved? I mean, give me an idea.
In Helsingborg, they built new blocks for about 400 apartments, so more than 1,000 people. And those had these separate pipes. And in the cellar of those buildings, you had this little fertilizer factory where the waste material was then transformed into pellets. And those pellets, yes, are available in supermarkets to fertilize your garden.
Uh-huh.
And of course, that's also new business, of course, to package and distribute these new products. But as Tanya said before, you know, we want to avoid that we have all this artificial synthetic fertilizer. And this is one way to recycle natural matter close to your users.
Yeah, I love the idea. Does anyone have any questions or observations to make to Frank? Yes, Tanya.
Yes. I find it very interesting. Thanks, Frank, for these explanations. My question is, what are the main barriers that you have found developing this technology? For example, I thought the first thing is that is urine, and then this has, for example, some other side products inside that you need to maybe filter, or how do you take care of that? And maybe any other big barrier that you find developing it is. Thanks.
Of course, you're absolutely right, Tanya, because it's such a different concept from what we have been learned from the Romans 2,000 years ago. You have to rethink a little bit and see what regulations are there that actually hinder some of your ideas, and also just the habits of people and the way architects are building their houses, or the way cities are laid out with the wastewater pipes. All that would have to be rethought, and those are obviously the barriers to work upstream when in the planning phase to make things different, and then to convince people, you're right, that there are no dangerous substances, and if they are, separate them. Of course, the hospital wastewater is different than a normal household wastewater, and you can also teach people not to mix certain toxic substances or medicine into the wastewater, which would create a problem downstream. So there's a whole education effort as well linked to that. But as we found, people are very cooperative, are very understanding, and very interested to make their contribution.
I think we're all just becoming progressively more and more aware of the input that and the footprint that our housing has on the environment around me. Everyone's very much more taken up, I think, not everyone, but quite a lot of people are more taken up with the idea of solar panels and alternative energy. And this is an extension, I think, another dimension of that awareness. Absolutely. Okay. Any other observations before I move on to Juan? Because Juan is coming at this kind of concept from quite a different angle. And when I say angle, I really mean angle, because we're here talking about the ground. And Juan is now going to talk to us about way up higher and looking back onto the Earth and using remote sensing technologies and Earth observation data to work out how to boost crop yields and to improve sustainability. So Juan, I'm going to turn to you. Your project was particularly looking, as the clue's in the name, at Africa. Your project is called the Africulturist Project, and it was focusing on the development of sustainable agriculture through, as I said, remote sensing, such as satellite imagery. Can you tell us what new approach your project brings to the table? Satellite imagery has been used for a while for agriculture, so what were you doing differently?
Thank you for the introduction. So, you know that Earth observation is a useful tool for monitoring what's going on the ground, and it's true that it's been used for years in the field of food production and agriculture to monitor yields to monitor what's going on, to get time series of information that is very useful to feed models, geoforecasting model, for example. But we realized that climate change is affecting food production in Africa and elsewhere. So then we needed to integrate also this climate science within the equation or the solution for the enhancement of food security in Africa. So we put together this well-known science on coming from Earth observation that is contributing itself to food security, together with this climate science to get a system of forecasting, for example, weather forecasting, the assessment of climate scenarios to provide means or guidance for adaptation to climate change. But also we put in the equation crop models, soil science, or other sciences that together are contributing to the enhancement of food security in Africa. Because they were in the past, as you mentioned, working like alone or cross-collaborating, but not strongly doing that in Africa. So what we wanted is to put this all together, but not losing the point that this should be a user-driven solution. So meaning that we would also to put the users in the center, not just the science and the technology, but to understand their needs, because they are the ones driven the solution so far, because it's to be evolved.
Okay, yes. Clearly harnessing these various elements builds up a much more detailed picture of what's happening. So I get your idea that you're bringing together a lot of different disciplines and a lot of different technologies in a way that maybe hasn't quite happened before. But can you give us some examples of what that actually means to a farmer somewhere in Africa? Can you be more specific about the actual practical results of this on the ground?
Sure. One of the results from the project is that really what we wanted to avoid to do like theoretical approaches to what can be done, but rather we wanted to have some use cases that are user-driven. So we, in the beginning, had our own ideas. We have the background on science and technology. That's why we set up a number of use cases in the countries we worked in. And for example, in Rwanda, we collaborated with the University of Rwanda to improve the National Agriculture Insurance Scheme that is missing of Earth observation or geospatial data for the assessment of claims to this scheme. In some cases, some perils occur, some there are floods or whatever, but it's costly going to the ground to assess what happened. So we are supporting the Ministry of Agriculture on this regard. Another case in Kenya is for the avocado value chain. We are not talking just of smallholder farmers, but also farmers that are producing for the commercial markets. So in the case of Kenya, we are providing information on the condition of the avocado value chain in the Muranga country. So then the government is able to get the local government and the farmers association are able to get early information on what can they expect out from the growing season and how much they can put and trade in the international market.
So what's the information you're giving them in real time that helps them to know that? Are you telling them, for example, how much precipitation they can anticipate through modeling? Or
we're providing information on precipitation. It can be so these agroclimatic variables on temperatures, precipitation, but the classical variables coming from, in many cases, from weather stations on site. We are providing information on the condition of the trees, how much they can be stressed due to these conditions, the weather, the heat, the drought, or whatever is happening.
Is that gained through modeling, previous modeling, or is that, I mean, for example, the condition of the trees?
It's a combination.
Combination. Because I think that's quite interesting. You know, you've got an avocado tree and you want to know how hard you can push it in order to get a certain amount of yield. What data are you using that you can give the farmer to tell them how healthy their tree is or how stressed their tree is?
In that case, in the case of on the stress, we are actually combining models because there are models that run alone with agroclimatical variables, but also we are combining this with direct observation. So through satellite imagery, just imagine a curve. So this is the normal. And then if we see decay on this curve is when, okay, something is happening in there. It can be due to a biotic stressor like a pest or a disease, or it can be something that is not really biotic, but due to the climate, for example. So then we point out something is happening there, for example.
Okay, fantastic. And that gives them the ability to anticipate and to plan accordingly.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. I think this is brilliant because, I mean, it takes up the whole notion of forecasting really up a level, and particularly in an environment or in countries which are, you know, not necessarily benefiting from basic forecasting. There, you're going from almost no forecasting at all to something that's extremely high tech and multifaceted. I think it's wonderful. Juan, I would like to ask you, why did you get involved in this? What was it that brought you into this concept, this idea?
From the beginning, I felt that this project was about people and livelihoods, right? So it was about not counting trees or whatever. So it's about the health of the people and the well-being of people that is producing food, some cases to trading in hubs, local hubs, but more most cases, in the case of smallholder farmers in Africa, is to support their families. So that's the world we wanted to, that's why I wanted to be involved in this, to provide something to someone, because at the end, we are going through aggregators to provide something to someone who's able to, at the end, deliver on the ground, to support these people on making decisions. And these people are not caring at the end on science or technology in the sense of satellites, but it's a satellite. It's flying above, I don't know, 800 kilometers above us or whatever. So they wanted to know or to get this information on when to plan or early warning on a drought, the onset of that drought, or it's time for harvest, it's time to this kind of decisions that we wanted to leverage.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. So it's a practical application of high tech. Yes, indeed. That's super. Well, I want to thank the three of you very much because you're all doing work that is very interesting and coming at the notion of basically improving food security and enhancing soil health, something that has in the past got a bit neglected, and the biodiversity in the ground as well under our feet. So thank you very much for all the work that you're doing on that and related areas, and for sharing your time with me today.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure, Abigail. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye. If you've enjoyed this podcast and are interested in the latest scientific research coming out of the EU, take a look at previous episodes available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, or find us on Anchor. Follow us to stay abreast of what's coming up. Are you curious about what other EU-funded projects are doing in the area of soil health, farming, resource management, and food security? The Cordis website will give you an insight into the results of projects funded by the Horizon 2020 programme that are working in this area. The website has articles and interviews that explore the results of research being conducted in a very broad range of domains and subjects. From cars to chaos theory, there's something there for you. Maybe you're interested in a project or would like to apply for funding. See what others are doing in your domain. So come and check out the research that's revealing what makes our world tick. We're always happy to hear from you. Drop us a line, editorial@cordis.europa.eu. Until next time.